We're going to do a couple rattlesnake stories today. Here we go. Rober the Rattlesnake Dog. This story is from a book called Rattlesnakes by J. Frank Dobie, one of my obviously favorite authors. Rover the Rattlesnake Dog. For the following first-hand observations on rattlesnakes and experiences with them, we are all indebted to John C. Myers of Eagle Pass, Texas. The I and the we in the narrative belong to John C. Myers, here quoted without quotation mark. Old Rover was hot on the trail of a coyote, dragging a steel trap. My brother, Clyde, and I were right behind him. At first, the trail was rather hard to follow, but soon went up a dry arroyo where we began to gain on the coyote. After a half a mile or so, we left the arroyo for an open, grassy country, and Rover had to slow down somewhat. Finally, we lost the trail altogether in sandy loam country where polecat flowers, wild lantanas flourish near a live oak moss. Rover seemed to have trouble separating the scent of the coyote from that of the shrubby polecat flowers. He was sniffing and sniffing among the bushes. We were about 10 feet away from him and were looking straight at him when he thrust his head into a certain clump. Suddenly he backed up with a large rattler that had struck him on the bony part of his muzzle, about halfway between nose and eyes, thrust itself into full view. Rover stood there momentarily in utter surprise, eyeing the rattler, which had assumed a striking position out in the open. Then Rover threw out the strangest roar I had ever heard a dog give. He was in a fury over having been struck and charged straight at that rattlesnake, grabbing it viciously and shaking it with such ferocity that pieces of snake flew in all directions. This happening was in Wilson County, Texas. I cannot say what part of the snake's body Rover grabbed. Many years have passed since then, but as I write now, I see Rover in the center of fantastically fast action, his ears flapping, growls coming from his chest, his head a blur of motion, making of the snake coils another blur. I do not think that Rover bit the snake in two. Reptiles are put together rather loosely, and it takes no great effort to literally shake one into pieces. Before long, Rover held only a short piece of the rattlesnake in his mouth. He dropped that and began to paw his nose and rub it vigorously in a clump of polecat flowers. He wallowed in the dirt, shook himself vigorously, and began hunting again. About another 100 yards out, we cut the trail, and from there on it was easy to follow. About a mile further on, we caught up with the coyote, which had snagged the trap in a hog wire fence it had attempted to climb over. I was carrying a brand new single-shot, rimfire, long-rifled, octagon-barreled Stevens Special .25 caliber rifle. Mr. Coyote was soon placed where he could catch no more of Mama's turkeys, which was the reason we were trapping for him. We were about 3 miles from home, and now Rover leading the way. He stayed in the lead all the way, not once hunting out or paying attention to anything else but the beeline he was following. I shot a cottontail rabbit and tried to give it to Rover, but he would have none of it, which was most unusual behavior. He trotted past the peanut stack lot, where he loved to lie and eat peanuts. He headed straight for his box under the workbench in a shed just behind the smokehouse. Later on, we tried to feed him some table scraps, but he would not eat, nor would he eat the next day or the next. He never left his box during this time, as far as we knew. His muzzle swelled some, but not excessively. However, the swelling around his eyes almost blinded him. A day or so later, I placed a pan of separated milk before him, and he eagerly lapped this up. He went back into his box, but later in the day he came out and lay in the sunshine. From that day on, his recovery was rapid and complete. As long as he lived, Rover became an implacable and deadly hunter of rattlesnakes. Day and night, he treed rattlesnakes. We would always tell when he had located a snake, for on such an encounter, he gave out a most weird, uncanny, and unearthly howl. When we heard this, we grabbed hoe, pitchfork, or rifle and went to his aid. For Rover would stay with his rattlesnake until someone came. As far as we knew, he never attacked or killed another rattlesnake after the one had bitten him. Although a small one he was baying at struck him on the tip of his nose. I never saw a house cat attack a rattlesnake, but cats do most of their hunting and prowling at night, out of sight. However, one day we noticed that our chicken house cat, so-called because she always slept on the roost with the hens, did not come out of the chicken house. Someone gathering eggs that evening found the cat in a hen's nest. She appeared to be very sick, and her head was badly swollen. The next afternoon, she was still in the nest, head still horribly swollen. The eyes were mere slits. She was completely blind, and she appeared to be in considerable pain. She never left the nest, as far as we knew, for a week. Finally, she threw off the venom and recovered, but she was permanently marked. A scar ran diagonally from one ear to the tip of her nose. The skin had burst on this line from the pressure of pus. Oh my God. Okay, that ends the story of Rover the rattlesnake dog. Do rattlesnakes swallow their young? There are at least two reasons why I would not want to live in Ireland. One of them is that there are no snakes in Ireland. And I wouldn't kill a harmless snake any more than I would kill a wren. Rattlesnakes, though, not harmless, are the most interesting of all snakes in North America. I hate to think of the day when there won't be any. They make the country more interesting and more natural. After all these generations of civilized man's association with them, there are several things about them that not even the most scientific naturalists know. Do they swallow their young? By asking that question and not flatly deny it, I, in the eyes of literalistic scientists, lay bare my credulity and ignorance. I don't care. Anyhow, popular testimony concerning this phenomenon interests me. Until very recently, the scientists denied that roadrunners kill rattlesnakes. Now they have to admit the fact. I assert nothing. I merely transmit. Nobody who's ever known Bill Gates, slow-talking, tall, angular, old-time cowboy, all the juices of fancy long ago dried out of him by the winds and suns of the plains, would suspect that his clear eyes had ever seen air-drawn daggers. I met him in Midland in 1934. He told me that while he was poisoning prairie dogs, sad, in Andrews County in 1930, he was nearing a dog hole to put some poisoned grain around in it when he saw a good-sized rattlesnake right at the mouth of it. Then he saw several small rattlesnakes near the old one. The big rattlesnake saw him, went to rattling, and opened its mouth, whereupon the little ones ran into it. Gates killed the old snake, he said, cut it open, and killed the little ones hiding inside. Dr. F. R. Seifert of the Mining Company gave me several instances of folk belief as such among Indians of the Sierra Madre and impressed me as being aware of the distinction between fact and fancy. After each of two or three talks I had with Dr. Seifert, I immediately set down what I wanted to remember. The account that follows is almost exactly his own words. In the year 1886, The year before I left Mexico to study at Washington University at St. Louis, I was walking one morning through the vegetable garden at Yoquibo, Chihuahua. I was traversing some rows of dried potato vines when I saw a small snake that appeared to have a rattle on the end of its tail. Just one rattle, a button. It had gone but a short distance, and I was following it eagerly when I heard a kind of whistle. I repeat, a kind of whistle. I was facing the source of this singular sound, which I knew came from nobody about the garden and which seemed to come up from the ground. It did come up from the ground. It came from a large rattlesnake, a female, as I was soon to learn, lying between two potato rows, just ahead of me with mouth wide open. Her color blended so perfectly with the ground, and she was not so still that I might have stepped on her without seeing her if it had not been for the whistling sound. Keeping my eye on her so as not to lose her, I reached for a clod. The ground being a very clayey nature, I found a good clod and was raising up to advance one step nearer and strike when I saw the little snake I had roused and had been keeping in sight dash into the mouth of the old one's mouth. Instantly, it was followed by a second little snake, then a third. I threw the clod, smashing the head of the mother, Rattler. I was exceedingly curious to examine her insides. You know, these people are pretty mean. I mean, they're violent. They have to kill things to figure things out, I guess. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway. I speared the head with my pocket knife, which had a long blade, and on it carried the snake to an old adobe wall that had been weathered down to about the height suitable for an operating table. I laid the snake on this wall and drove a sharp stick through the head into the adobe. Then, withdrawing my knife with one hand and holding the snake's tail with the other, I split its belly open. Five little snakes came out, each with a button. This is the only time I've ever seen this snake swallowing phenomenon. I have not known anyone else who has seen it. I read of it in a book by German naturalists. I tell only what I've experienced with my own eyes. Now I quote from a letter by Hardin H. Jones of Brady, Texas. My experience was at the Texas National Guard camp at Palacios in August 1927. Some of the boys, while cleaning up the officers' mess hall, had killed a rattlesnake and were bringing it down our company street on the way to the trash pile. I and several other boys saw the snake and of course wanted to examine it. The fellow who was carrying it threw it on the ground. In order to examine the fangs, I picked up two small sticks and pried open the snake's mouth. Then I noticed a peculiar color down the snake's throat. I raked with one of the sticks and brought out a tiny rattlesnake. In like manner, I raked out three more. This is all I saw. The little ones were in the lower part of the snake's mouth, just above the throat. They had not been swallowed. They were from 3 to 3.5 inches long and had the diamond markings rather indistinct with a slight yellow tinge, and each had a button at the end of its tail. I do not know whether the old snake was male or female. It was about 3 feet long and had, as I recall, 8 rattles. By going over the roster of the service company from Brownwood of the 142nd Infantry of the Texas National Guard camped at Palacios in 1927, several witnesses to corroborate this testimony might be found. Mr. John Fullinger of Lawn, Texas, tells me that he once cut open two large rattlesnakes he had killed together and found young unborn snakes in each. Arden Jones, author of the foregoing account, has an inquiring mind and is especially interested in Texas history. He makes it clear that he did not see any snakes swallowed. On April 27, 1935, he wrote me another letter relaying the testimony of a fence builder, trapper, and all-around outdoors laborer named John E. Morris. In the spring of 1905 or 1906, Morris was building a fence on the C.P. Gray Fence Ranch on the San Saba River in McCullough County. One day, he was nearing a small thicket. He heard a short rattle, then another short rattle, then one long or two brrrs, I guess. That's what it R-R-R is. When he located the snake, she had her mouth open, and a little snake was just going in. She closed her mouth and opened it again, and another little one ran in. She opened and closed her mouth for each entrant until several had gone in. Morris moved closer, and the snake glided into a hole, as did several small snakes that had not got in to the old one's mouth. Morris had a spade and a post hole digger in his hand. He dug the old snake out and killed her. They have to kill them, don't they? Also, five or six small snakes. He cut the old one open and exposed 15 or 20 small snakes, all in a ball, tangled up and wiggling like a can of worms. They were about 6 inches long each with a button, and they attempted to fight. Only in one other source have I met the description of little snakes being massed. This is in the brief sketch by Ernest E. Hobart of the Frontier and Midland Magazine, published at Missoula Mountain, Montana. Okay, and this is his account. It had become a habit with us, he says, to open up all the gorged snakes we killed. It was surprising how many field mice, kangaroo rats, chipmunks, and other small rodents these reptiles could hold. Now, an unusually fat rattler hastened to wriggle out of the way before it could reach the hole at the base camp of a cactus clump. At the base of a cactus clump, I cut off its head with my light spade. I held down the tail of the still twitching body with my foot and started cutting into the cold, greasy entrails when Kirby gave a sharp warning. Drawing my hands away quickly, I saw with astonishment a wiggling mass of tiny snakes pop out of the opening I had made. Darting rapidly about the body of the dead mother were six very small young rattlers, perfectly formed and about 8 inches long. Thrusting patches of red flannel at them, Kirby soon had those babies coiling and striking. Then he began grinding his hobbled heel into the tiny poison-filled heads. Oh, God. We had heard that the young rattlesnakes were hatched from eggs laid in the warm sand, yet here were six of them found alive within the mother's body, active and ready to defend themselves as soon as they struck the ground. We learned later that the young are hatched from eggs, but within the parent, thus giving the impression that the young rattlers are swallowed by the parent. The rattlesnake, like various other reptiles, is ovoviviparous, hatching its eggs within its own body. B.O. Grant, a schoolteacher at Ibex, Texas, knew this and had for 12 years been observing snakes from the point of view of an amateur herpetologist when in May 1937 he saw something contrary to all herpetological teaching. While he was walking across his pasture, he heard a slight hissing sound near a crevice on the hillside. Looking down into the crevice, he saw a large rattlesnake lying between two rocks and small snakes crawling into his mouth. He killed the snake with stones and then, to prove to himself what he had often denied, he cut the snake open and removed the small ones. There were 18 of them, from 5 to 6 inches long. Okay, there's a lot more of these stories, but, you know, they're all saying the same thing, so Oh my goodness. Unfortunately, they're all killing them. Okay, let's find another story. The Mockingbird and the Rattlesnake. The Mockingbird and the Rattlesnake. Okay, here we go. Roy Bedichek, late of the University of Texas, probably knew more about mockingbirds than any other man in the world. I owe him the following account of the belligerent mockingbird's attack on a rattlesnake, as written by Professor M. L. Williams of Southwestern University at Georgetown. In the summer of 1893, I was with my father on the Hinton Ranch in Mocola County, about 10 miles west of Lone Post Office. It was my job, or rather one of my jobs, to ride the fence around the pasture to see that no one had taken it down and that no cattle had gone out of the pasture. One day, while I was on my job, I was nearing a dry branch of the west side of the pasture when I heard the sound of a rattler ahead. Riding cautiously, I was about 30 yards from the branch when I saw a large diamond rattler on the opposite bank up under some bushes. The bushes were of oak type with no low underbrush, about 12 or more feet high. I could see the rattler clearly, his tail singing steadily. I knew there was something wrong, but I could see no cause for his anger. I decided to wait. After some minutes, he suddenly stopped and quickly started to run to the south. He was hardly well extended before a mockingbird darted from above and, flying down his length, struck at his head, circled above, and quickly came down again, sweeping down the snake's back. Each time, the bird made some 4 or 5 strikes at the head of the snake. Then the rattler stopped, coiled, and struck several times and began to rattle. I was fascinated and rode up within some 20 feet of the snake. Then I saw that one of his eyes was out and bleeding. My remembrance is that it was his right eye. In a few minutes, the rattler made another dash, the mockingbird in the meantime having perched on the limb just above him. Immediately, the bird went into action as before. The snake again stopped. This fight went on for 30 minutes or more, the scene of action moving some 30 feet. The snake seemed afraid to be trying to escape. The bird gave him no chance. Finally, the bird struck the other eye, held on, and flapped vigorously, then darted up. The blood spurted from the eye. The rattler coiled and began striking in all directions, then sank his fangs into his own body, began rolling over, and finally came tumbling down the bank into the rocky branch, where he writhed in pain. The mockingbird flew up into the branches and began to sing. I put the rattlesnake out of his misery with a large stone. The snake of the large diamond type was, I guess, about 5 feet long. I have seen other interesting contests between snakes, spiders, etc., but I think none more thrilling than this one. Another account of the mockingbird-rattlesnake feud was given to me in a manuscript form by my good old friend, now dead, Don Alberto Guayardo of Piedras Negras in Coahuila, Mexico. He had spent a long life in the vast ranch country of northern Mexico. Here is his account. One day, while I was out in the pasture with the shepherd boy, he said, "There goes a large rattlesnake. Do you wish to kill it?" "Surely," I said, "but where is it?" "There, near the evergreen oak. It's going towards the brush. My little daughter Josephine, at that time 6 or 8 years old, was playing near, and I wanted her to have the opportunity to see the snake. I took a horsewhip, and guided by the shepherd boy, we followed to the spot where the snake was. "Look, master," he pointed, "those birds you see have been driving the snake to chase it away from their nest and young. A pair of mockingbirds were chattering loudly and darting around the snake, which was crawling slowly, dodging their intended pecks. The birds had their neck feathers ruffled in anger. They paid no attention to us as they continued to chase the snake. The boy wanted to kill the snake with a whip, but I said, 'Let us see what the mockingbirds are going to do.' 'They only chase it from their nest,' he said, 'but if there are two or three nests, all the birds get together and kill the snake.' When the shepherd struck the snake two or three times on the head, it became a little dizzy, and we withdrew somewhat to see what the birds would do. They flew down and pecked until they had pierced the head and killed it. 'Come on this side, master,' said the shepherd boy. 'Yonder in the evergreen oak, about 80 paces from here, is the nest from which the mockingbirds chased the snake. We went directly to it. There on the ground beneath was the reptile's track.' The boy then explained that many times he had killed snakes betrayed by the loud chattering of mockingbirds. 'It is too bad that Don Alberto allowed the shepherd boy to wound the snake and thus intercept the course of nature. He may have been mistaken in saying that the mockingbirds pierced the head of the snake instead of the eyes. The snake has no eyelids. I have seen several mockingbirds darting at a coachwhip snake and making a great deal of noise, but did not see the bird strike. Perhaps this was because the coachwhip was in a tree and the birds could not get a clear strike at it. They were certainly deterring it, however, from making progress towards a nest. One recalls Audubon's famous picture of a mockingbird picking out the eye of a rattlesnake actually in the nest of a tree." Okay, we're going to do a couple more if I have time. Let's see. Ebola. Okay, this is called Snake Killing Cats and Dogs. "For years I've kept a letter written by Mrs. J. R. Thompson of Lancaster, Texas. One night in Alabama, when she was a little girl, 65 years before she wrote me, the family cat, Katie by name, brought in a live black snake for her kittens. The snake was numb, but could wriggle. Katie seemed to have been a good provider. I do not recall Miss Thompson's letter reads her ever bringing in a poisonous snake, but mice, scorpions, scaly lizards, sunrunners, more black snakes, garter snakes, and even butterflies and a large grasshoppers she put on her table, a shelf outside our window for the kittens. Katie disappeared for 6 months or longer once when she was about 2 years old. We children were desolated, and then one morning Katie was back. Sometime after this, she became ill. She had no appetite, or she could not swallow. We tried tempting her with everything we could think of. She only grew weaker. Then, as a last resort, one of us caught a cricket and put it before her. She ate it. For days afterwards, we roamed the grounds around our house hunting crickets. She would follow us, and whenever we clapped down on a hat or a bonnet over a cricket, she was right there to catch it. She recovered, and we children vowed we'd never again kill a cricket unless it was for Katie. We've kept our vow. We had an English coach dog named Kino, who seemed to take particular pleasure in killing rattlesnakes. I saw him kill a large one once. He would circle it, making short grabs and barking furiously. After dodging strike after strike, he finally grabbed the snake by the back of the neck and, biting down hard, shook it to death. I've never seen a cat or dog kill any kind of snake, but I've heard other testimony to the effect that the dog catches the snake just back of the head. This is not precisely the technique described by Mr. William Allen Maddox in an interesting book called Historical Carvings in Leather published by Naylor Company in San Antonio. According to Mr. Maddox, their family dog named Shep would circle around and around the rattlesnake, barking excitedly while the snake rattled, getting closer and closer in his circles and inducing the snake to strike at him, but always dodging the strike. After the snake had struck as far as he could, Shep would spring forward and grab him around the middle of the body. Then he would shake him for all he was worth. When he laid the snake down, there was only one piece in his mouth and other two pieces out of the ground in opposite directions. According to Mr. Maddox, a dog usually has to be bitten at least once to become cautious enough to be an expert at snake killing. One young dog he owned had learned to kill snakes with the old dogs and had not been bitten until he got his lesson. He would dodge the rattler's strike just as any dog would dodge a blow. One day, while I was taking a drink of water to my father plowing a field, this dog and I encountered a large rattlesnake. The young dog made short work of him. The head came off with a 3 or 4 inches of snake and rolled within about 6 feet of me. The dog seemed to be proud of his achievement and went around smelling the pieces. I was examining the snake's rattles and never noticed the dog until it was too late. The mouth of the snake was still wide open, and when this foolish young dog struck his nose into the jaws, they contracted. He ran backwards, pawing at his nose with both forefeet. He finally raked his head free of the fangs. Before we could get into the house, it was swollen badly. My mother gave him all the fat meat he could eat. He was sick for several days. His head swelled out of proportion. After he got well, he had it in for all snakes and never seemed to be happy as when he was killing them. He was not bitten a second time. In 1938, an old-time cowman named W. H. Hamilton had an autobiography published in the South Dakota Historical Collection. Herein he tells of a greyhound, one of a pack, that seemed unable to learn how to fight rattlesnakes. The first time he was bitten, recorded W. H. Hamilton, I was sure he would die. His head swelled so badly he could not chew or swallow for several days, and he spent all of his time lying in the mud down at the creek. He was the only dog we had which would grab a snake while it was coiled. We had others that would kill snakes, but they would always wait until the snake started to crawl and then grab it and shake it to pieces. I think this dog became immune to snake venom, for he got so it affected him very little when bitten. Not long ago, my friend Arthur Woodward of California, while on a visit to me here in Austin, dictated the following account of a cat's technique in fighting rattlesnakes. In the summer of 1908, when I was about 10 years old, my family moved from Iowa to California and were living in the little town of Ramona, about 38 miles southeast of San Diego. Our house was framed, painted green, up on a rock foundation high enough for one to crawl under. I had never seen a rattlesnake, never heard one. Sitting by the window one day, roses outside and bees in the roses, I kept hearing an insistent buzz above the bee loudness. I'd hear a cat's meow and then buzz. I told my dad, I think a rattlesnake's out there. No, that's bees. No rattlesnake, he'd say. I said, I hear something that's not bees. I went out and looked under the house. Our old cat had her 3 kittens lined up in a row, though they were lying down, while she fought a little rattler about a foot long. It was rattling and the kittens were fidgety. Every time one of them made a move forward, the old cat would reach back and knock it gully west, clear away from the snake. She would wait until the snake struck, and then she would hit right behind the head and knock it. She kept knocking it out further and further in the open and finally knocked it clear out from under the house. We killed it, but she would have killed it by herself, no doubt. Every time it struck at her, she would hit it just behind the head. Okay, last story I'm going to read. Ebola of rattlesnakes. So many things happen in the fall that I wonder why Julius Caesar didn't fix the beginning of the calendar year at this time instead of in the standstill time of midwinter. Fall is the time for all sorts of changes. It is the time when rattlesnakes change their dispositions and are drawn towards their dens as instinctively as birds migrate. In a caveless county, like the coastal plains of Texas, rattlesnakes do not gather in large numbers to hibernate in a common den. They scatter into badger holes, rat nests, and other coverts. Yet they seem to have a tendency, perhaps only sporadically exercised, to congregate before moving. Birds which are biologically descended from snakes may have inherited this tendency. Certainly, they exercise it with more regularity. The great restless congregations of birds of many species before migrating are one of the spectacles of nature. The congregations of rattlesnakes are equally spectacular, though only a few people have reported it. Sight. I spent Christmas in the year of 1932 at, this is the same place, Quisquiriac, Chihuahua, west of Chihuahua City, as guest of the manager of the Quisquiriac Mining Company, where I met a most vivid reporter of rattlesnake gatherings I have ever come across. He was the Quisqui Company's doctor, F. R. Seffert. In blood, he was quarter German and three-quarter Spanish. Having been born in Mexico, he had been educated in medicine in the United States, was scientific-minded, and at the time I knew him, was about 65 years old. He had spent most of his life in the mountains of Mexico, and was as familiar with pack mules, prospector hopes, native folklore, and canyon trails as he was with femurs and gastric juices. He was quiet and precise in speech, rather sympathetic towards the wonders of this world, as I am also. When I recall his talk now, my heart leaps with joy. It was so interesting to me. Immediately after he gave me the accounts of rattlesnake gatherings that follow this introduction, I wrote them down on Christmas Eve night. On September 15th, 1898, Mr. Seffert said, I was riding between Santa Rosalia and Arenosas on the edge of the Bolson de Mapimi of Chihuahua. After leaving Santa Rosalia on the Conchos River, I entered a sandy country abounding in prairie dogs and rattlesnakes. I saw a rattlesnake and got down off my horse to cut a mesquite switch to kill it. I had been on medical call and had no pistol or rifle. It is troublesome, as you know, to cut any good-sized switch of the thorny mesquite with a pocket knife. After I had cut it, I looked where I had seen the snake, and it was no longer there, though its trail in the sand was plain. No expert enough to tell from a snake's trail which direction it has taken. I made no effort to hunt the snake down. I turned towards my horse and had taken but a few steps when I saw another rattler. I killed it. As I looked up, I saw another. I killed it. Then another, and I killed it. As I recall later, all three of these snakes were, when I first saw them, crawling towards a shallow gully, maybe 2 or 3 feet deep, several feet wide. The third rattler I killed was almost on the edge of the gully. When my attention was free and I looked over into the gully, I saw a sight that literally froze my blood and made my hair stand on end. There, almost at my feet, was a writhing, squirming mass of rattlesnakes, hundreds of them, it seemed to me. The twisted, twisting ball they made was certainly 2.5 feet in diameter. It was a solid mass of rattlesnake bodies, and rattlesnakes all around it were somehow entangling themselves with Ebola. The snakes were not rattling, they were just crawling and writhing. I ran to my horse, mounted, and left. It is a common belief among Mexicans that rattlesnakes gather in this way during their rutting service season in the fall. According to scientists, rattlesnakes mate in spring. I have never seen them mate, though I have talked to men who have. Can anybody who has seen rattlesnakes mate be sure of the time of year? I am sure of the date on which I saw this boa of rattlesnakes, Mr. Seifert went on. I have never kept diaries, but I know that I made the ride the day before the DSCSA September the 16th celebration. An experience narrated by Francisco Delgado, a rancher near Quisuyariac, corroborates the phenomena I have described. Delgado, accompanied by a servant, was on the trail to Batopilas, Chihuahua, with some pack mules. One noon, after they had launched and let the mules graze a while, Delgado told his mozo to go bring in the animals. They were not far off. Delgado put the coffee pot and other lunch things in a morral and went to adjusting something about one of the pack saddles. He paid no attention to where the mozo had gone. Presently, he heard a cry of distress. He recognized the voice as coming from the servant. Nobody else could be crying out in that immense solitude anyhow. He looked, but he could see no human being. His hand was on his pistol when he heard a second cry of distress, fainter than the first. It gave him the direction, however, and he ran towards it. It seemed to come from a dry arroyo, and when he saw two of the mules on the other side, when he came to where he could look down into the arroyo, he saw the man stretched out flat. He was already dead. He was amid hundreds of rattlesnakes. Some were crawling over him. Most of them were in a great bola toward which the others were squirming. The man, meaning to go across the arroyo to bring back the mules, must have jumped into it without noticing the snakes that he landed among. What brought them together? Only one who can interpret the overpowering impulses of nature can say.